we have to treat this in isolation. This wasn't part and parcel of a grand Israeli strategy. This is an act of revenge on a unit that was attacked by Hezbollah that lost, maybe lost its commanding officer, maybe lost a lot of senior people that the Israelis, that 8,200 didn't want to lose. I think you have to view this in isolation. But Israel does not, the Israeli military does not want a war with Hezbollah. That's one thing that is certain, because they can't win a war with Hezbollah. You get to pull the pager stunt once. They did it. That's it. Don't get to do it again. Hezbollah is not that stupid. Now you shot that bolt. You got the result you wanted. Now you have to pay the price, because Hezbollah will respond. And then the question is, does this draw Israel into a war it didn't want to get into? Maybe you shouldn't have popped off 1,500 Hezbollah members if you haven't thought through the consequences. Who knows? But I think what happened with the pagers is more an act of revenge than part and parcel of a grand strategy of Israel towards Hezbollah.
Yeah, because it seems that they're talking about that this type of attack is just preparing the situation to have a bigger attack on Hezbollah, just disconnect them from each other.
No.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't change the battlefield outcome. So I said, this was an act of revenge by Unit 8200. That's it. Pure and simple. Now, 8200 may have been sitting on this capability, and they could have pulled this trigger in war. But the thing is, once you go to war, those pagers disappear. Electronics disappear. You don't communicate. Cell phones get put into devices that shield this. They go to wartime communications capabilities, runners, landlines, things of that nature. So, this is a capability that has almost zero utility in time of actual war, because those pagers are gone. No one's carrying around electronics in war. But we're still in this, sort of hybrid warfare moment where there's combat going on in the front, but people still operate as if things are normal in the rear. And Unit 8200 gets to pull this off one time. They did it. It's done. But it's not, this isn't a weapon used in war. This is a weapon you'd use as a precursor. Now, had this happened in a vacuum, just out of the blue, they said, pop, 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 I'd say, oh, maybe they're getting ready to do something. But I think this happened because 8200 took a heavy hit, and this is their act of revenge.
Yeah. Before this, we had Houthis using a ballistic missile, it seems, that to attack Israel and a military base, I don't know if somewhere near Tel Aviv. How capable right now, can we have any sort of understanding on how capable Houthis are right now, and how many missiles do they have, in your opinion?
We know they had at least one, and it hit its target, and the Israelis couldn't shoot it down. The Americans couldn't shoot it down. Nobody could shoot it down. That sort of answers the question about how capable that missile is. It doesn't matter if it meets the classical definition of hypersonic. I think it does. The Houthi call it a hypersonic system. We know that its performance characteristics are such that it was not able to be intercepted by the Israelis using their most advanced systems, or the United States. How many do they have? I think the Houthi are smarter than the average dog, and means they have more than one, that they have this capability. They demonstrated this capability. They're inviting an Israeli response. Let's see what the Israelis do. And then the Houthi will unleash the remainder of their missiles, which are probably, can be counted in the dozens at a minimum. And Israel will pay a heavy price because they can't shoot them down. There is no solution to these missiles. Iran, which has these missiles in the many hundreds, if not thousands, Hezbollah has similar capabilities in the many hundreds, if not thousands. The Houthi just did a proof of concept demonstration to the Israelis that hypersonics will penetrate anything you got and hit the targets they want to hit, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And that sends a chilling effect. The Houthi did that because it's difficult for Iran and Hezbollah to do now, given the level of tensions. That's why it's just one missile. This is the Houthi sending a signal to Israel that the Axis resistance has your number. We can destroy you anytime we want to. You can't shoot down our missiles. We'll hit every target we aim at. And I think the message was received. I think it is another reason why the 8200 pager attack took place. Because while Netanyahu is screaming about going into Lebanon, the military saying we can't stop Hezbollah from hitting us with these hypersonic missiles. And the Houthi now have said they're going to join in on that fight. And what happens if Iran joins in on that fight? We all die. And so while they're talking about this, you know, while Netanyahu is, you know, reviewing the fate of Gallant, 8200 went, well, screw it. Boom, take out the Hezbollah guys just because we're mad. I'm sure they coordinate with their leadership, but I think it's just an independent action that has nothing to do with the overall Israeli Hezbollah direction that's heading place. You know, 8200 got hit hard by Hezbollah and they got their revenge.
It seems that the way that they're trying to dissipate the focus on the part of Israelis, because Hezbollah and after that Houthis, and right now again Israelis are attacking Hezbollah. And did you find this attack of Houthis as a part of Iranian response to Israel, because they don't want to attack Israel directly, or maybe they're planning?
100%. I mean, first of all, with all due respect to Ansarallah, and I don't mean to diminish them at all, they carried out testing for this business. If this was an indigenous Yemeni designed and produced missile, there's just significant testing that has to take place to turn design concepts into reality. Static burns of the rocket design, it never goes right the first time. It doesn't go right the second time. Usually it doesn't go right till about the 10th or 15th time when they go, oh, we got the formula, the design, everything right. It performed well. Now we have a booster. Now you got to take that booster. You got to have a second stage. That second stage also has to be tested, different performance characteristics and everything that you're looking at. Then you got to assemble it, and then you got to do the flight testing, see if the guidance works and things of that nature. None of this happens the first time. You don't go, let's test the booster. Boom, perfect test. Wow. Let's test the second stage. Boom, perfect test. Wow. Let's do a flight test. Functions perfectly. Let's go into full operational, full scale production and turn this thing into an operational missile. It doesn't work that way. You need to do multiple tests. So the Houthi did this very fast test, which tells me that they've received components from Iran that they're assembling. They may incorporate some indigenous, produced parts and components to that missile, but by and large, this is an Iranian design that's been sent to Hezbollah, that Hezbollah is able to assemble. Hezbollah maybe was given the production designs so that they could build a production capacity that could replicate that which is done. So maybe they produced some and they did a quality assurance test to make sure that functions according to design. But if it does and you've done everything right, that's whether you produce it in Yemen or produce it in Iran, doesn't matter. It's an Iranian design. The bottom line is this is an Iranian missile and it functioned and Iran sent a signal to Israel. The Israelis aren't stupid. I mean, I worked with them in the 1980s, right after the Gulf War. They assembled all the different ballistic missile parts from the various missiles that Iran had fired into Israel into something like a Scud graveyard, little museum for missile geeks. And, the Israelis reverse engineered these things. And then as a weapons inspector, traveled to Israel, I got to go to the Scud graveyard and deal with these missile geeks and work with them. And, we brought out new information about Iraqi efforts regarding the reverse engineering of this, and we went back and looked at the various parts, and suddenly things that the Israelis didn't have answers to, they suddenly had answers to, and then together we looked at it and we started to say, oh, well, the Iraqis could do this, the Iraqis could do that, and then we could take it to the Iraqis after they said, well, we couldn't do that, we'd say, well, you could, here's the evidence, and they went, oh yeah, I guess we did do that, and we got the truth. The point I'm trying to bring out is the Israelis are pretty damn good. They can take bits and pieces of missiles and put them together and do the reverse engineering necessary to understand the totality of it. I'm sure that they have picked up debris from this attack, and they are reading. I don't want to get too far into it because it's fascinating for me. It probably bore your audience to death, but to take a piece of debris and then make it tell a story is just fascinating science. Because and you have to know everything about how missiles are produced to do that. You have to know about, you know, manufacturing techniques, because you're looking at welds. You have to know about if it's liquid, you know, the kind of metal that's used, the rolling processes that are used to create the stage. You can look at that when you look at the thickness of it. You know, and so you're able to start to say, oh, this is how it happened. This is how it was done. And then you start to get a bigger picture, and then you can investigate those parts. And then the whole thing comes together just from a little piece. And the Israelis are doing that now. And I'm certain the Israelis, because they're not stupid, are going to look at, you know, fuel composition. They, you know, I'm sure there's aspects of the solid fuel that survive. They're going to look at fuel composition. They're going to be able to reverse engineer that to find out, you know, what the various chemical ingredients are, where you source these chemical ingredients. Does Yemen have the ability to source these chemical ingredients? Is there any evidence of Yemen sourcing these chemical ingredients, or Iran? Does Iran produce it indigenously, or does Iran have to acquire capability from abroad? And then you spread that thing out, and the Israelis are going to be able, from looking at a piece of debris, put together a picture that will be fairly accurate. Fairly accurate. It won't be 100%, because there's just different things. You're doing a lot of speculation here. And if you start speculating down one track, that's happened before. we were going in one way and someone went, well, you know, that was a nice story that we told ourselves, but we were wrong about the very first thing we were looking at. Because we got it wrong, all the speculation led us down a false pit trail. You know, so you can get it wrong, but the Israelis are pretty good, and I'm sure they know, and this is important. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that they will produce a report that goes to their military leadership about capabilities, and they will do an assessment based on that, on what they think the production capacity of Yemen is, or Iran. You know, based upon the complexity of the missile, you can make a guess of what it would take to assemble such a missile. You know, what the infrastructure support requirements of are, that, and then what the production rate would be. And from that, you can determine what the possible size of the arsenal of Yemen is, the availability, or Iran, or Hezbollah. And then you can say, we can't shoot this thing down, and they've got X number of them, and we're in a lot of trouble. So all that from a little piece of debris.
Yeah, but in the eyes of Israelis right now, when you look at the situation, it's not just Hamas and Hezbollah. You see Iraqis, you see Houthis, you see even in Syria. Do they understand what's going on with their position right now? Because the way that they're trying to escalate, if you were to advise them, what would you say to them? Because right now with the situation and the way that they're trying to escalate the situation, it doesn't seem that any good outcome would come out of this for Israel and the way that they're trying to attack Hezbollah. And because of the conflict with Hamas, they're just involved in Gaza, and how they can just focus on all of these fronts on their part. Can you understand that?
Well, I mean, first of all, when evaluating what's happening in Israel today, stop talking about Israel. Stop. You're talking about the wrong thing. Remember what I said? If you got that little piece of missile and you get it wrong on your initial take, you say, aha, that's an assumption we made now based upon this. And then we go down and we do this whole analytical chain. But because we got it wrong here, all of this doesn't matter because it's fantasy. If you start by talking about the security of Israel, you're talking about the wrong thing. Because if you talk about the security of Israel, then everything we're talking about makes no sense. Because Israel is destroying itself, literally destroying itself. It's destroying itself economically. It's destroying itself socially. It's destroying itself domestically in terms of politics, and globally in terms of geopolitics. There's nothing going right for Israel right now, nothing. And everything that's going wrong is leading Israel down a path of its imminent collapse, literal collapse. Israel is committing suicide as we speak. And many Israelis know this, they recognize this. So stop talking about Israeli security. Start talking about Netanyahu's political legacy. This is about the preservation of a narcissist, of a man who has put himself above Israel, above Israeli security. It's only about Netanyahu and what can preserve his political viability and the political viability of the very limited coalition that he's built around himself to govern. A coalition, in order to survive, needs to project itself as a wartime coalition, because that's the only way it can justify its continued hold on power. If Israel were to head down the path of peace, if a ceasefire was arranged, then Israelis would be called upon to solve a whole host of issues, which are the source to the problems created by Netanyahu and this coalition. So everything that's happening, whether it be a conflict with Hezbollah, continued violence in Hamas, it's all about Netanyahu preserving his hold on power. And as such, all these problems we talked about for Israel will just continue to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And the Israelis are increasingly coming to that awareness. The question now is, what do they do about it? You know, but here's the problem. You know, there's a whole bunch of people that were in the streets, hundreds of thousands, that were demanding Netanyahu's resignation over the hostages. And there's many people outside of Israel that said, see, there's sanity in Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people rallying against Benjamin Netanyahu. Yeah, that's exactly right. Rallying against Benjamin Netanyahu. You know what they weren't rallying against? Genocide. They weren't rallying against violence against the Palestinians. The vast majority of Israelis today support the continuation of violence. They support the concept of a greater Israel. They support Zionism. So even when you get rid of Netanyahu, there's no solution to this problem. Israel is going to die. It has no choice, because in order to survive, Israel has to do things that it can't survive. In order to survive, Israel is going to have to solve its geopolitical problem. And that can only happen with the creation of a Palestinian state. Right now, the term being bandied around is a two-state solution. Okay, let's talk about that. What does that mean, a two-state solution? Well, first of all, you have to overcome, well, who's going to govern the Palestinian state? Israel has put forward a precondition that says Hamas will not be allowed to govern. Well, Hamas is getting around that by working with the Chinese and the Russians and the other Palestinian factions to create this this joint governing authority, of which Hamas will be a part of, but it won't be called Hamas anymore. And they're going to try and slide that in there. Even if Israel says, okay, we'll work with those guys. What do you do about the West Bank? You see, Israel's been engaged in illegal actions in the West Bank. The West Bank settlements will have to be dismantled. There's no other option. You can't have a two-state solution and have West Bank settlements. Incompatible. But if Israel, in order to survive, Israel has to, you know, take it down itself down a path of viability for a two-state solution, which means Israel will have to dismantle the West Bank settlements. There you'll have a civil war, a literal civil war. The West Bank settlers have been armed. They are an independent militia. The police force in the West Bank has been politicized to the extent that their sole job is to empower the settlers to continue to murder, rob, steal, rape, whatever they do against the Palestinians. This all has to go, and it's not going to go peacefully. There will be violence. And I don't see Israel embarking on a policy of self-destruction. So, you know, right off the bat, we're saying that a two-state solution isn't going to happen, and it isn't going to happen. So now what happens? Because Israel can't create a two-state solution, the only answer now is going to be a one-state solution, and that isn't going to be greater Israel. That's the Israeli solution for a one state. Yeah, we already have it. Call it greater Israel. Get rid of the Palestinians. Isn't going to happen. What's going to happen is Israel, in launching these rearguard actions, is going to continue to see its standing in the world community deteriorate. They're going to continue to see domestic, divisions, as Israelis begin to recognize that the only choice they have is a two-state solution, but now they have to dismantle. So there's going to be problems there. The economy will never recover from where it is right now. In order for the economy to recover, you're going to need Israel to normalize relationship with states who say we can't normalize until there's a two-state solution. And we already said that isn't going to happen. So the economy will continue to deteriorate, and the security situation will never stabilize. Even with a ceasefire, As long as Israel's at odds with its neighbors, as long as you have issues in Hamas, there's going to be violence or the threat of violence. And eventually the combination of the economic collapse of Israel with, a social environment that isn't conducive to the image that Israel tries to sell to the world of this peaceful nation where people come in prosperity and live in harmony with everything. That isn't going to happen. And people are going to flee. And that's the death of Israel. When you get more people fleeing that are coming in, there is Aliyah. Yes, there's a romanticism attached to Israel amongst the Jewish diaspora. And, tens of thousands of Israelis return every year, maybe hundreds of thousands. I don't know. But what we have right now is hundreds of thousands of Israelis leaving. And when that number turns into the millions and is sustained over a period of time, you'll see the Israeli population drop from its current level of 9 million. If the population drops down to 6 million to 5 million and the non-Jewish population is 9, 10, 11, 12 million, 15 million, demographics alone dictates the outcome. Which is a single state solution called Palestine. And I think that's the direction we're heading right now.
Do you think that the intelligence they're receiving from the United States is telling them the reality of what's going on for Israel, or they're just the same thing happening as in Ukraine? They're just reporting not totally in line with the reality of what's going on the battlefield, on between Ukraine and Russia, but right now between Israel and Palestinians and Hezbollah. I'm talking about the intelligence, how intelligence is honest with Israeli on the part of the United States.
Well, the problem is, in order to be honest with Israel, the United States has to be honest with itself. Given the overwhelming influence of the pro-Israeli lobby in the United States, it's impossible to have this kind of honesty. I mean, the first thing we'd have to ask ourselves is the pro-Israeli lobby seeking to influence the outcome of the 2024 presidential election? There's the fundamental question. It's one that one would hope that the Department of Justice, its National Security Division, would ask with the same fervor as appears to be asking whether Russia is interfering with the 2024 presidential election. One would hope that the FBI's National Security Division would investigate these pro-Israeli factions with the same fervor that they investigate, those who are alleged to be operating on behalf of Russia. One is a fantasy, that's the Russian story, and the other one is reality, the Israeli story that we don't want to confront. So we're not even honest with ourselves. So when you start off, just the opening proposition is America is incapable of being honest with itself about Israel, then the intelligence doesn't matter, because for intelligence to work, just a quick briefing on what intelligence is. People keep going, well, intelligence is what happens when an American hands the Israelis a piece of paper and says, read our intelligence. And the Israelis go, oh my God, you're so smart. You're so wise. Oh, we should have listened to you to begin with. That doesn't work that way. The first thing in intelligence, in order for it to become intelligence, is that you need direction. All right. Forget all the spy versus spy stuff right now. The first component of intelligence is direction. That means a consumer, the president, the National Security Council, Congress, Department of Defense, somebody says, I want to know this, puts out a question. And then the intelligence people, that would be me putting on my intelligence hat, go, oh, let me talk to you more about your question. What exactly do you want to know? And I dig down into it. And I find out why he's asking the question, what he wants to know, or she. And I say, okay, I got this one. And I come back to my shop and I break it down. I say, here's the big question. Now, to answer this, we have to ask additional questions. We call these essential elements of information that in their totality allow me to, if I answer all these, I'm able to come up with an answer to the big question. And I break down each EEI. And then those are broken down into individual intelligence collection requirements. And those are actions that need to be taken, questions. We got the EEIs, I break them down into specific things. And then in order to answer each one of these things, I have to link it to an intelligence collection capability. Human intelligence, signals intelligence, imagery intelligence, we call MASINT, those are overall signals intelligence, open source intelligence. There's a whole bunch of different sources, and we cast them out to the collectors, and then the collectors go out and collect. Or do they? Because if you're a human intelligence collector and now you're going out to collect, you still have to come up with a human intelligence collection plan. I need to meet this person. I need to get access to this person who's going to answer the question that we've asked. We've said, who can answer it? This person can answer it. How do I get to them? This is what I need to do to get to them. And then supervisors look at it and go, whoa, what? You think you're going to do that? That isn't going to happen. You know, no. Boom, that's too politically sensitive. The ambassador may say, because the ambassador runs all CIA operations inside his country or her country that they're in. And they may say, no, that's stupid. You're not going to get to do that. And so there's already manipulation taking place. Sir, I want to intercept the phone calls of Emmanuel Macron because I want to know what he's saying to this person. Yes or no? It could get blocked. So even as you break this down, there's all that. And then once you collect this information, it goes through the basic assessment. You collect it and say, what does this mean? And that's done at the local level, the junior guy. You do that. And it gets up to a mid-level analyst who now brings it together. That's their job, to bring it all together and answer the question. Write something to answer the question. The problem with the mid-level guy is two things. One, they don't do the actual briefing of the boss. They just put it together. Two, they want to be the person that briefs the boss. They want to get promoted. And so they'll write it. And it's an honest reflection of the actual intelligence that's been collected, even though maybe you weren't allowed to collect all the intelligence you needed. And then you present it to your boss and say, this answers the question. And the boss goes, no, it doesn't. Because your answer is no. The boss wants the answer to be yes. But sir, it doesn't. This is no. No, you're not understanding me, Scott. If you want to be the person to get promoted, this has to say yes. And then I have to go back and rewrite it. So it says yes. And then my boss takes it and takes it to the consumer and says, yes. And then we take and give it to somebody who reads it and says, oh my God, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. No, it's a lie. A lie. 100% lie. And that's the problem with U.S. intelligence and Israel. We can't be honest with ourselves. The mid-level analyst responsible for, you know, assessing the data to produce the assessment that gets sent up to the top, isn't allowed to give the answer they want because politically it's unacceptable. If you could give the answer you want, we'd shut AIPAC down a long time ago for being, they brag about spending $100 million to buy elections. They spent $24 million to defeat somebody in a primary and nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. I can guarantee you that every junior analyst is going, that's the biggest problem we face right now. Not allowed to talk about that. You can only talk about this. And you're only allowed to give the answer that the boss already wants. They ask the question knowing the answer they want. And that's the problem, is the direction. If the direction is honest, I really want to know the answer to this because it will influence the decisions I make. But what's really happening is, say, I've already made my decision. Now I need to cover my butt. I need the intelligence to back me up on this. So it's not intelligence. It's fiction. It's fiction writing, very expensive fiction writing.
Yeah. How do you find the next 2 to 3 weeks for the position of Netanyahu? Do you think that he's going to do something big? Because his position is not that good right now. And what does he need to do, in your opinion, in his eyes? And what is he trying to do to improve his position in Israel?
Survive. That's all he's about right now, is survival. It's how do I, Benjamin Netanyahu, last until November 6th? Because on November 6th, a fundamental question is going to be answered. Who's going to be the next president of the United States? And at that point in time, Israel is liberated. See, right now, Israel can't go against the policies of Joe Biden because Joe Biden's the president of the United States. And if they go against the policies, it makes Biden look bad. And then Biden can do things to punish Israel that normally wouldn't be politically viable. But now in the time where they're trying to desperately keep Donald Trump out of office, there's no telling what Biden will do to stay the course with the policy it deems to be most conducive to putting Kamala Harris in the White House. The Israelis can't work on the assumption that Donald Trump's going to be the president, because if he's not, then they hung themselves out to dry. So Netanyahu's job right now is to survive between now and November 5th. And then on November 6th, Netanyahu will take a look at the reality that's manifested itself because of the will of the American people, and he'll adjust accordingly. And that's what I think is going to happen for the next, what do we got, 50-odd days before the election.
I do believe that nobody gonna support Netanyahu the way that the Biden administration did, because in any sort of, if Kamala Harris wins or Donald Trump, both of them have their sort of policy toward Israel. Donald Trump is willing to support Israel as much as possible, but at the end of the day, he's not willing to risk a war, a big war in the Middle East, because he knows how important that would be for the economy of the United States, for the economy of all of these countries in the European Union. And on the other hand, Kamala Harris is not that much in line with the Biden's policy. The way that she was talking about their policy in Gaza, I do believe that she's not totally in line with what Biden did so far. Do you think that in the eyes of Israelis is the same, or they're finding differently?
Well, first of all, let's talk about Kamala Harris. I don't think she knows anything about Israel. I don't think she knows anything about the complexity of this problem. What she knows is that she has a problem in certain swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, that she has to win to win the White House. And she's lost the Muslim American population there. In fact, as much of the Muslim American population, which in a very tight race nationally, is against her. And this could cost her the election. So she's advised by people who say you need to assuage them, to say things that's, you know, that make them believe that you're on their side, but she doesn't truly believe it. So one of the problems right now is, if you're talking about Kamala Harris, you don't know what she's going to do on November 6th. You literally don't know, because once the election is done, if she won, she doesn't need the Muslim American community anymore. She'll dump them like a bad habit. She'll go the easy route, because what she'll need then is the support of the establishment on not just issues pertaining to Israel, but pertaining to Russia, to China, et cetera. It's all tied in. And she's not going to go against the establishment. Donald Trump, on the other hand, you know, is putting a lot of effort into winning over the pro-Israeli crowd. But we don't know what he's going to do on the 6th. The pro-Israeli crowd is part of the same establishment that's backing bad policy in Ukraine and China. And Donald Trump is a businessman. Donald Trump is going to want to do things that improve the economy of the United States. So you don't know what Donald Trump's going to do on November 6th. Now you come to Biden. Biden is a lame duck president. He has to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't become the next president of the United States. In order to do that, his policies have to conform with what Kamala Harris is saying on the on the campaign trail. But on November 6th, he has between then and January, 20th, to put his final thing. And you say, well, no lame duck president does that. I just want to remind people that George Herbert Walker Bush, when he turned the presidency over to Bill Clinton, his last act was to attack Iraq, because he wanted to make sure that Bill Clinton, a man who said that he's willing to work with the Iraqis to resolve these problems, entered the White House at war with Iraq. So, the presidents are capable of doing very dangerous things policy-wise to tie the hands of their successor. And so Biden, who knows? Again, different options for different outcomes. But, he may be opposed to things that Kamala Harris says. And if she doesn't surround herself with people that match the Biden policy objectives, Biden could try and tie her hands with doing things in Israel one way or the other. The same thing with Donald Trump. I guess what I'm trying to say is anybody who thinks that they know what's going to happen between now and November is smoking dope. And if you think you know what the outcome is going to be come January on inauguration day, again, you're smoking dope. This is a very complicated question that's fraught with problems domestic and international.